Hey, I want to finish up chapter 14, just a few statements we had left, and look at the exercises on chapter 14, and then we're going to be doing some more review and summary of the verbs we had before. We'll have another little quiz coming up here pretty soon on verbs, and I'll tell you about that more as we go on. There's kind of a short one first, and then a couple weeks later maybe a longer one. So, chapter 14, we almost finished it yesterday. We're at the very last part of the chapter on page 84, talking about hutos and akenos. The last point we were talking about was the fact that hutos and akenos, when they're in predicate nominative constructions with equative verbs, just like other adjectives, are going to also, in those conditions, agree with the predicate. The demonstrative has the gender, number, and case of the predicate noun. But there is a very common idiomatic phrase, tut esten, short for tuto esten, which doesn't always follow that. And it's not too difficult to identify this or see what's happening just on the basis of the idiom. But you've always got a neuter singular form for tuto in tuto esten, regardless of what's on the other side of the equation. Okay. And then part number three, hutos may be used with autos, as in, so you may see hutos and autos together, in other words, and egraps aututo auto, I wrote this very thing. So what's happening here is that autos is functioning like a noun, and is taking a substantive meaning, and once it does that, then it can take other adjectives, and so if it can take other adjectives, there's no reason why it can't take the demonstrative, and so you get tuto auto. Auto functioning is a noun in this particular case. And we saw autos used that way, the very thing or the thing itself, so forth. Okay. Then, number four, hutos and akenos may also modify nouns which are modified by other adjectives or which have other ordinary adjectives in one of the predicate positions. Okay, so hutos and akenos now are always being used in predicate positions when they modify a noun, but they can modify nouns that have other adjectives in attributive positions or nouns that have another adjective in a predicate position as well. Look at the examples here and you'll see what I mean. Hokakos doulos akenos means that wicked servant. Say hokakos doulos is the attributive position for kakos, so kakos, bad is modifying, wicked is modifying doulos. And then akenos is in a predicate position modifying the whole works. Now you could just as easily have akenos out in front, akenos hokakos doulos, or hokakos doulos akenos. The main point though is you want akenos in a predicate position. Yes?
What would happen if you wanted to have that servant is wicked?
That servant is wicked? Okay. Right. Well, they'll give you some. I think they'll give you some examples further on down here. Well, the last example does that. But basically, what they'll do is put kakos in a predicate position as well as akenos, and usually that's done by one on either side. One's in a first predicate, one's in a second predicate. So, if you wanted to say that wicked, that servant is wicked, most likely you'd see something like kakos odoulos akenos. Or you could say akenos hodulos kakos, either one. Okay?
You'd never see them together.
Well, no. In other words, you mean the two words kakos and akenos,
right,
side by side? I'm not so sure that can't be done, as long as they're both in this, you know, they would both technically be in a predicate position, but every time I've seen one, it's like this. They'll polarize it, put it on one side or the other. Okay? Mark 12:43, Hechera haute te toche, this poor widow. Okay, here we have haute in a predicate position following the noun chera, and then the article repeated and another adjective in the attributive position. So this is kind of what I was getting at when you asked that question. Here's a mixture between a predicate and attributive, but still we see the demonstrative here in a predicate position, and then the whole unit can, in effect is being modified by the hey pro hey afterwards.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of unusual to me that they would split up that attributive position of
mm-hmm.
okay,
mm-hmm.
and but out there right in the middle, why wouldn't they just stick out the end?
Oh, you might see it. You're probably more likely to see it out at the end, really. perhaps for emphasis, especially with the demonstrative. Demonstratives, you know, are something that are more emphatic. So with a demonstrative, it's not unusual to see it stuck right under the end of the word and then see the other thing repeated. You'd have to take a poll of the New Testament, but I would guess that you'd see it more often the other way. This is giving you a little bit more emphasis.
More often sticking out, hey, off in the front,
right.
Not split down.
Right. Either out in the front, saying, hey, chera, haute, hey, chera, hey, ptoche, or perhaps way at the end. Hey, chera, hey, ptoche, haute. But with a demonstrative, again, if something funny is going to happen, it'll probably happen more frequently with a demonstrative adjective than with another kind.
Will you find other adjectives in this position, like this?
Well,
between,
you know,
in a predicate position, between
what is an attributed situation? You got a good question there. That I would be inclined to doubt. If you had an adjective that was in a real predicate position, which, you know, implied a verb to be in English, that I think you'd be seeing far less likely. I don't see any reason why it would be impossible. But you see, you're almost breaking up a very definite structure when you do that, because now you're getting a verb to be in before you get your attributive adjective back onto the noun. And so I think that would be much less likely to be seen.
There's a lot of things we can do.
Right, but a lot of things you don't.
Uh-huh.
Right. Yeah, and you're familiar with the fact that in many of these rules, it says what generally occurs or what most often occurs and so forth is not an ironclad thing. I wish it would be easier if everything was ironclad. And the Hebrew students are familiar with that too. The way Landon writes his book, he's real careful about that. You always find that there's exceptions to just about everything that's not really nailed down solid. And especially in areas where word order is involved, you're going to find a lot of variations. And those variations are usually dictated by the kinds of emphases that the author's trying to express. Okay, Matthew 24:26, Makarios hodulos ekenos. Here's a more common type of order that you'll see. Blessed is that servant. Okay, Makarios, word for blessed, adjective, predicate position, and so we are translating with a verb to be, Makarios hodulos, blessed is the servant, and then ekenos, also in a predicate position, but ekenos, of course, doesn't have that predicate type of meaning. It's still attributive, even though it's a predicate position. So it's blessed is that servant. Blessed is that servant. Yes.
You're going to say that is the blessed servant. You have to say Kenos esteem, and then
yes,
in a attributed position.
Right. Yes. If you want to say that is the blessed servant, you could say Kenos esten ho dulos ho makarios, or Kenos esten ho makarios dulos. But you'd have to put makarios now in an attributed position, and then supply a verb, a form of the verb to be, between a Kenos and the other. Okay. All right, let's take a look at those exercises in Lesson 14. I didn't assign you to do A and B, just C. So let's go through A and B first of all in class, though, and just do it together if you haven't done it. And use this as kind of a teaching aid and a further confirmation of things we've been looking at. 14A, indicate whether the following statements are true or false by placing T or F to the right of each. Number one, in the paradigm of hutos and B, the definite article, the rough breathing occurs on corresponding forms. Is that true or false? Okay, we've got one bit for false, some of the bits for true. Okay, yet it turns out to be true. The rough breathing occurs on corresponding forms. Now, if you look at your paradigm for the article, the rough breathing occurs on what forms?
Masculine and
feminine, right. Nominative singular and nominative plural, masculine and feminine. And what occurs on all the other forms? The first letter. Tau. Tau's on all the rest of them. So they've either got tau or they've got a rough breathing. Now, in the paradigm for hutos, as you can see on page 82, the same thing occurs. We've got hutos and haute for the masculine and feminine singular nominative. All the rest of them begin with tau. And then the masculine and feminine plural nominative, hutoi and hautai, same situation. So it is on corresponding forms in the paradigm. So, and that's a good aid for you to memorize this paradigm, is to remember that the article does the same thing as this thing does, and vice versa. Okay. Number two, in the paradigm of hutos, the diphthong alpha upsilon occurs in the first syllable of all feminine forms. Is that true or false?
False.
False. What makes it false? Yeah, the genitive plural form. The genitive plural form has an omega nu ending, and it's got an omicron upsilon diphthong in the first syllable. And as I mentioned to you the other day, one way to help remember whether it's alpha upsilon or omicron upsilon is to look at the ending, see if it's an O-type ending or if it's an alpha or an eta-type ending. That'll determine whether it's alpha upsilon or omicron upsilon in the first syllable. Seems to be an attempt to make a kind of a rhyme out of it, as it were, or something of that nature anyway. So the genitive plural form makes this false. Number three. In the paradigm of Hutos, the diphthong alpha upsilon occurs in some masculine forms. Okay, that's false. That's false. None of the masculine forms have that. Only most of the feminine forms and a couple of the neuter forms get the alpha upsilon, but none of the masculine forms do. Okay, that's right. Number four. In the paradigm of Hutos, the diphthong alpha upsilon occurs in some neuter forms. That's true. That's true. In your nominative and accusative singular form, or nominative accusative plural forms, where you have the off ending. And number five, in the paradigm of Hutos, the diphthong alpha upsilon occurs in the first syllable only in forms whose endings contains alpha or eta. That's true. That's true. So it's only in those forms whose endings contains alpha or eta. Okay, number six. The endings of Hutos are the same as those of the article. Okay, that's false. And can you point out which forms make it false? Yes, the nominative singular here. Let's see, the nominative singular and okay, the neuter. Well, let's see, the neuter singular. You could call that the same. Toe, you see, you've got two toe, and then the article is toe for the neuter singular nominative. But it's that nominative singular in the masculine. You see, the article is whole, or this is Hutos, omicron sigma. So that's your main culprit there. Is there any, are there any others? See, all of us, we've got hoi and hi, those are okay. Ta, that's okay. Looks like everything else is okay. Toe, okay, hey. Yeah, just as far as I can see, it's only the masculine singular nominative form that makes the problem.
Well, that's not too bad, because that's how you learn the word is Hutos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. If you learn the word is Hutos, then yeah, that's good. Good point. Okay. Then number seven, the endings of Hutos are the same as those of Autos. Endings, yeah, that's true. The endings are the same. Okay. And that's because basically the endings are like any other adjective except for that neuter nominative and accusative singular, and autos has the same peculiarity there, so the endings are the same as autos. Okay, number eight, the endings of Hutos are the same as those of Akenos. Okay, same thing there, yes, true. So that's kind of why these three are lumped together. Those ending systems are the same for Hutos, Akenos, and Autos. They're all three the same as far as their ending systems are concerned. Okay, number nine, Hutos sometimes occurs in the first attributive position. Okay, that's false. Never, never, never in the first attributive position or in the second attributive position. Always in predicate positions. Okay, and then number 10, Autos sometimes occurs in the first attributive position. Yeah, that's true. That's true. It's true for Autos. See, Autos, but it has a different meaning. And Autos has a different meaning depending on whether it's attributive or predicate position. Okay, then 14b. Place an X in the parentheses before the expression which correctly completes the statement. Okay, number one. In the construction Hutos Hokurios, Hutos is in, you've got two choices here, the first attributive position and the second attributive position. Four choices.
Five.
Neither one of those. Five, okay. All right. Yeah, I saw where my X was and I cut it off there. So we got first attributive, second attributive, first predicate, second predicate, none of the positions just named. So which is it? First predicate position. Okay. First predicate position. Number two, in the construction to technon auto, auto is in either the first attributive position, second attributive position, first predicate position, or none of the positions named. Which is it?
Yeah.
None of the positions named. Okay, right. Yeah. So it'd be the second predicate position, which just wasn't named. Number three, in the construction tuto poterion estin, tuto is in, is it for a first or second attributive, first predicate, second predicate, or none of the above?
None of the
above. None of the above, okay? And the reason there is that we have an anarthrous noun, and the demonstratives never modify anarthrous nouns. So this is none of those positions because there's no modification taking place. Instead, what we have is that tuto is acting like a pronoun. And we have a verb to be there connecting the two. Okay, number four, in the construction ho autos mathe tes. Autos is in first attributive, second attributive, first predicate, second predicate, none of the above.
First
attributive position, right. First attributive position. Okay. So how would that be translated? Ho autos mathe tes.
Same disciple.
Yeah, the same disciple. The same disciple. Okay. And then number five, in the construction ho mathe tes tu kuriu is in, is it first attributive, second attributive, first predicate, none of the above?
Second
predicate position, right. Second predicate position. Genitive phrase can occur in all four of those positions with the meaning about the same. Okay, then 14C. In the blank spaces in the Greek sentences below, insert A, the correct form of houtos, autos, or arkanos, and B, if necessary, the correct form of the article so that the Greek will correctly render the English which precedes it. Imitate the models provided. Okay, we've got a couple model sentences here. Model one, this disciple sent the child. Ephem sento technon houtos homate tes. And in the example, the houtos ho was supplied here. That was part that was blank. And the model two, this disciple sent the child. Ephem sento technon homate tes houtos. And there's houtos being supplied. Okay. So, in other words, sometimes you're having to supply the article because they're requiring you to know that this is having to occur with an articular noun in order to make any sense. Number one, the disciple sent this child. Ephem sen homate tes blank technon. What goes in the blank?
Tuto.
Yes. Tuto to. Tuto to. Remember to technon. Okay. Tuto to. Okay. You can get quite a string of these sometimes with syllables. Tuto to technon. And this, there was, with the genitives, you get tutu, tu, you know, and so forth. And sometimes you can get a whole string of them like that. It's really funny sometimes. Okay, number two, the disciple sent this child. Epemsen homate tes to technon blank.
Tuto.
Right, tuto. So we just need a predicate position here. We don't need any article repeat. If we repeat the article, then we don't have a predicate position anymore. Number three, the disciple sent the child to this widow. Epem sen homate testo technon tehera blank. Taute. Taute, yes. And there's a yoda subscript on that ada there. It's dative. Taute. Okay. This is just a good exercise in forming these paradigms. Number four, these disciples sent the child. Epem san to technon hoimate tai. What? Hutoi, yes. Hutoi. Rough breathing on there, omicron epsilon tau omicron iota, hutoi, nominative plural singular, nominative plural, excuse me, masculine. Number five, the same disciple sent the child, epem sento technon blank mathetes. Okay, we've got, I heard autos ho, and I heard, what else did I hear? Ho autos, okay. Now the difference there would be, if it was autos ho mathetes, how would it be translated? Yes, the disciple himself sent the child, or the very disciple sent the child. We need it ho autos, okay, ho autos mathe tes. So this is just an exercise in showing the difference here. Autos in the attributive positions means same, and in a predicate position it's going to mean the very or the thing itself. Okay? So it should be ho autos mathe tes. Number six, that disciple sent the child. Epemsen to technon ho mathe tes blank. Ekenos, right. That disciple. So the thing you have to be watching for with these demonstratives is whether it's this or that, so you know which word to use, and whether it's, when you include autos in the picture, whether it's predicate position that you want or attributive position, and if it's a kutos and a kenos, of course, it's always going to be predicate position. Number seven, the widow of this disciple sent the child, Ephemsen, to technon hechera blank mathe tu. Yes, tu mathe tu. Okay? Alright. Tu mathe tu. Okay, tu is one word and then tu. So you've got this exact same syllable repeated three times. Okay? And then stuck on the end of mathe tu also. Number eight. So again, you needed the article there in order to make that predicate position. Number. Was there another question on this, anybody? All right. Number 8, the widow herself sent the child, epemsen totechnon blank chera. Let's say the widow herself. Yes, aute he chera. Aute he chera. Need that in a predicate position, of course, to get that meaning. Number 9, the child of that widow sent the disciple, epemsen ton mathetain totechnon blank cheras. Right, ekenes tes cheras. Ekenes tes cheras. Again, we want predicate position, and we need the article to define that. So you're going to need the article on it. Yes, Glenn?
I'd like to ask a question.
Sure. Way. All right, fine, go ahead.
Excuse me. I'm a little confused here. I looked at chapter 101, Autos Davi, in proper names.
Yes.
And I didn't add the article.
Okay.
The widow herself.
Uh-huh.
You can't do that
to an ordinary noun. Only a proper noun. See, a proper noun has got a definiteness even without the article. David is a proper name, so it carries a certain definiteness. You can get by without using articles on proper names, although sometimes the Greek will do it. In other words, sometimes you'll see Paulos, Hodoulos, Jesu Christou. Sometimes you'll see Ho Paulos. You see, so you'll see a proper name like that with or without the article. And so what he's saying is that you can get by with a word like David without putting an article on it and just sticking autos on it. But with an ordinary noun, it's not a proper noun. You've got to have the article in order to get this predicate position defined.
So,
well, it's not necessarily should have. That's kind of a toss-up. I would say about 50-50 on that. Sometimes you'll see it with the article, sometimes you won't. But it's still definite even without the article. So think of it. It still is almost as it's got an invisible article or something when it doesn't have it. Because it being a proper name, it's got that connotation. Yes, any other regular noun has to have the article let's put it this way. An ordinary noun, in order to have a demonstrative modifying that noun, you've got to have the article there. Because a demonstrative is a definite idea. And the only reason that you can get by without the article on a proper name is because a proper name is already definite without the article. Okay? Yes?
What in Greek is giving us the idea of the precision of
The preposition of, it's coming out as the genitive case. It's just the genitive case. See, the normal translation of a genitive case form is the preposition of in English. So in this case, which one were we on? Number 9, are you asking about? Yes. The child of that widow. All we need to say is totechnon, and then suppose if it was just the child of the widow, instead of without of that widow, it would just be totechnon tes cheras. And now it's because we want to say of that widow, we're adding the adjective, demonstrative adjective to it, so that's going to also have to be in a genitive case. But genitive case is all you need. You don't need anything else. Now, Greek can do some other things. You could see ek sometimes in a case of preposition ek, out of, especially in a case of genealogy like this. Ek is not an uncommon thing where, the son came out of the father, and ek will often be used that way. But many times you won't see any preposition at all, just the genitive phrase. This is a kind of a pure idea of the genitive, it's indicating the source, indicating the origin. Okay? Was there any other questions on number 9 here on the forms? Tes cheras, ekenes tes cheras, need a predicate position. Okay, number 10, these children sent the disciple, epemson ton mathe tein ta tekna blank. Tauta, yes, tauta, neuter plural. Okay, number 11, those children sent the disciple, epemson ton mathe tein blank ta tekna, blank tekna, I gave part of it away. Yeah, ekena ta tekna, ekena ta tekna, all the endings. And you need the article there to define, in order to be able to have a demonstrative modifying a noun. Number 12, the same children sent the disciple, epemson ton mathetein blank tekna. Yes, ta auta tekna, ta auta tekna. Article first, and then the adjective in order to get the idea of same. Remember, if you put it in predicate position, then it's going to mean the very instead of the same. So because we want to say the same children, we have ta auta. Now in the next sentence, the children themselves sent the disciple. Now we have FM Santo Matitain blank Tekna. What happens there? Auta ta Tekna, right. Just the reverse of the word order. Auta ta Tekna. So predicate position here gives the meaning of themselves, and attributive position earlier gives the meaning of the same. Okay, number 14. The child of that good servant, the child of that good widow sent the disciple. FM Santo Matitain to Teknon tes kales cheras blank. Ekenes, yes. So here's an example where we have an adjective in the attributive position modifying cheras, and then we have also our demonstrative adjective now in a predicate position modifying the same noun. So tes kales, cheras, ekenes. Number 15, the disciple sent the child to the same widow. Epem sento teknon homate tes blank chera. I want to say to the same widow. Te aute chera, right, with yellow subscripts on both those edas. Te aute chera. Okay, we have to have it in that position, attributive position, in order to get the meaning of same widow. Number 16, the disciple sent the child of the same widow. Epem sen homathe tes to technon blank cheras. Tes autes cheras, right. Tes autes cheras. Again, the same word order because we're dealing with predicate position, attributive position to get the meaning same. But now we have it in the genitive case because now it's a prepositional phrase modifying child, and at least in English. But it's a genitive case in Greek. And no prepositions needed. Number 17, the disciples themselves sent the children. Epem san ta tekna hoi mate tai blank. Autoi, right, autoi. Okay, just a nominative masculine plural form. Number 18, the disciples sent the children of those widows. Epem san hoi mate tai ta tekna ton cheron blank. Ekenon, yes, ekenon, omega nu. Okay, those are really easy. Number 19. That child sent the disciple. Epem son ton mathe tain blank technon. Here's a. Yes. Ekeno to technon. That's omicron endings. Ekeno to technon. This is the place in the paradigm where it diverges from your normal paradigm for kalos, because we get just an omicron ending there on the adjective instead of what you're used to in omicron nu. So it's just like the article in that respect. So if you remember it's like the article, it'll be a lot easier. Number 20. The widow sent the child to that disciple. Epem sen hechera to technon to mathete blank. Ekino. Ekino. Omega with the Yoda subscript. Yes, and remember mathetes is the first declension masculine noun, so the adjective is going to have to have a masculine form, ekino. Any questions on any of those? Any fundamental problems with this? The basic bottom line of chapter 14 is we're dealing with three unusual adjectives. Autos is unusual in two respects. First, in its paradigm because of that odd ending, like the article in the neuter singulars. And it's also peculiar in that it has a different meaning depending on the position. Attributive positions give the meaning same. Predicate positions give the meaning the thing itself or the very thing. And then hutos and akenos are demonstrative adjectives. They are never used in attributive positions. They're always in predicate positions. And they also have some peculiarities in paradigm, and I think hutos, of course, would be the most unusual there. Kanos is no more unusual than autos, but hutos is unusual in that you get this tau in the beginning of some of the forms and a rough breathing on some of the others, and you get omicron upsilons versus alpha upsilons, and you have all those, also the same peculiarities and endings that the article has. Okay. Any other questions? Yes, Mark?
Number 14, would we see tes cheras, ekenes, tes kales?
Yes, you could see that just as easily as that other one we saw in the example. I don't know how frequently you'd see it, but it's possible. That word order is possible. You could say tes cheras, ekenes, tes kales. You could see that, sure. Mm-hmm. And you might see... I think the most common word order that you'd see for this phrase would be ekenes tes kales cheras, ekenes out first. That's probably the most common, but it's certainly not the only form, as you can see here. All right, any other questions? Okay, what I want to do next is mention that chapters 12 and 13, we dealt with our basic verb forms. What I'm going to do today and tomorrow... if it takes that long, is to review all that information and give you a kind of a paradigm format to put in your notes on all of that and summarize all of that. And that means we'll have a quiz upcoming on this. Now, we have a vocab quiz, this Friday. So we have a vocab quiz on that second list of words that I gave you. And then on next Wednesday, which is a week from today, we'll have a short quiz. This won't be any longer than a vocab quiz. In fact, about the same. But it will be dealing with these verb forms. It'll be giving the right verb form. And there won't be much vocabulary now. It'll only be using the verbs in the vocabulary list that we've already got, plus a few of these irregular first aorists and second aorists that are in the book, just a few that are in those lists. I'll tell you exactly what it'll be on. But that'll be next Wednesday, a week from today, and it's a shorter quiz. It's not a big test like the last one was, but it's another quiz about like a vocab quiz, but it's just on these verb forms and these paradigms of verb forms. So what you'll be asked to do is I'll give you an English phrase, and you'll give me the Greek verb form for it, and I'll give you the Greek verb form in some cases, and have you give me the English. So it'll mean you'll have to recognize whether it's present, future, imperfect, or aorist. Those four tense ideas, and then whether it's first person, second person, third person, and whether it's singular or plural. So, and they're all going to be active indicative forms and so forth. That's all we've had so far. So, and so we're not worried about those things. But that's what it'll basically be involving. So I'll tell you exactly what verbs you'll be responsible for. Basically, this I can tell you now, and I'll tell you again, just to reconfirm it. But you'll be responsible for the verbs on this last vocab list that we had. I gave you a list of verbs. I can't remember how many there were, something like 11 or 12, something. I didn't remember the count. 12? Yeah, 12 verbs. Luo, pistuo, akuo, pempo, grafo, calupto, dioko, anoigo, keruso, petho, baptizo, and ago. So those verbs you'll be responsible for. And then also the irregular first aorist and second aorist on page 78. So if you look at page 78, I can tell you which ones you'll be responsible for here. Page 78 in your textbook. The very top of the page, we have a list of five irregular first aorists. They're first aorists because they have the alpha-type endings, but they're irregular first aorists. So you'll be responsible for the last three of those five, Pharo, Crino, and Meno. Those three. You don't have to worry about didomi and tithemi. Those are me verbs, and we're going to deal with those separately. But so you can skip those, which is nice. But Pharo, Crino, and Meno, those three are irregular first aorists. Those you'll be responsible for. And then the next section down, you find five verbs that are second aorists. Lepo, Ago, Hirisco, Echo, and Hamartano. Those you'll also be responsible for. Those five. So those will be the only second aorists you'll see, and the only irregular first aorists are those three above. So if you know, what you're going to need to do then, of course, is memorize these principal parts that are involved here, and at least as far as these go. So you'll want to know both the future and the aorist forms you see for those irregular first aorists, because some of those futures are irregular too. Like hexo and hureso, those are irregular. Hamarteso is, I guess you could call it irregular on the basis of what we've seen before. Haven't seen that yet. So, lapso is okay, oxo is okay. But, so that's what you'll be responsible for. And but it's just mainly a test to get you used to recognizing forms and forming the forms. So, what we'll do now then is go through the mechanics of this again in a paradigm format. We won't go through the chapter again, but I'm going to kind of present it to you a little bit different way just to wrap up some of the questions and simplify everything as much as I possibly can. So this will be a review and a simplification of chapters 12 and 13. Yes? Yes, both ways, both directions. In some cases I'll give you the English and you give me the Greek and vice versa. About 50-50, half and half both ways. So it's always easier to go from the Greek to the English, but you'll need to go from English to Greek as well. So that means you'll have to be familiar. You have to learn that vocabulary for the vocab quiz anyway. So just retain it. Put that into permanent storage in your memory banks, and then you can just spit it out again for this other test, plus all the endings and paradigms and so forth that go with it. Okay? Let's see what we can do about clarifying all of this material, though, and see if we can approach it in a way that We'll solidify your understanding of it. Okay, this is kind of a summary and review of the verb discussions we've had so far. First thing is that Greek verbs are inflected for more than English verbs are. In other words, English verbs have certain inflections, but Greek verbs have a lot more. And Greek verbs show person, number, tense, mood, voice, and often aspect also. So that all of that information is indicated in a Greek verb form. Person, number, tense, mood, voice, and often aspect. And we haven't talked a lot about mood and voice and a little bit about aspect. So we're mainly concerned right now with person, number, and tense. But mood and voice and aspect will become more important a little bit later on. We've already seen aspect in with respect to the past tense, the imperfect versus the aorist. Well, there's the only difference between the two is the difference in aspect. In other words, the kind of action. Now, Greek verbs agree with their subjects in person and in number. So this is the rule of concord. A Greek verb will agree with its subject in person, and that is first, second, or third person, and in number, singular or plural. So since we have three persons involved, and they're not the persons of the Trinity, the first, second, third person, in other words, the I, the you, or the he, she, or it form, and because we have two numbers, singular and plural, three times two is six. There's six possible forms then for every verb with regard to person and number. So the six variations. And so the standard paradigm format is going to be first person singular, second person singular, third person singular, first person plural, second person plural, and third person plural. Okay. One nice thing that the Hebrew students will notice about Greek as opposed to Hebrew is that in Greek, you at least have, you don't have any distinction between masculine and feminine in the verb forms. Whereas in Hebrew, except for the first person forms, you generally have, and sometimes the third person form, you generally have a distinction between the, in Hebrew you've got second person feminine plural, second person feminine singular, and masculine and feminines for the singular form, second person, and for the third person forms, and so forth. So the paradigm's a little bit more complicated in Hebrew, so you can rejoice, those of you that are taking only Greek and not Hebrew right now. Okay? But Greek makes up for it in other ways. Okay? Now, the dictionary form of a verb is going to be the first person, singular, present, indicative, active. That's the full description of the dictionary form. First person, singular, present, indicative, active. So this is unlike English. In English, the dictionary form of the verb is the infinitive. And we talk about to go, to be, to see, and so forth. We use the infinitive form. That's what we look up in the dictionary. Because in English, the infinitive form is usually the shortest and simplest form. That's not so in Greek. The infinitive form is often a little bit harder to recognize than some of the other forms. They do have an infinitive form, which we'll talk about later on. But the most convenient form for Greek paradigms and for Greek discussion is the first-person singular form. That's got the pretty much the shortest and simplest type of an ending system on it. So that's the form that's used. First-person singular, present, indicative, active. So to start, we're going to study the Greek equivalents of our simple past, present, future tenses. Those are the ones you use the most often. Those are the ones we want to get started with so we can start talking a little bit of Greek. So we need present tense form, past tense forms, and future forms. And that's what we'll be looking at. Now all of the forms that we have so far are in the indicative mood. So all the things we're going to be talking about here are indicative mood. Indicative means simple, making a simple statement of fact. And they're in the active voice, meaning that the subject is the performer of the action in an active voice. Now there's such thing as a passive voice where the subject receives the action. So just to show the difference, I see is an active verb form, but I was seen or I am seen is a passive verb form. In the first one, I see, the I is performing the action of seeing. In the second one, I was seen, the I is the one that's receiving the action of being seen. So that's the essential distinction. And there's a middle voice also in the Greek, which is sometimes harder to translate into English, but it's got the idea that both the subject is both performing the action and also involved in receiving the benefit of the action, often in a reflexive sense, but sometimes even beyond that. So for example, if I bathe myself, that is an action that I'm performing, but I'm also receiving the benefit of the action. Or if you do something to yourself, something reflexive, you perform an action upon yourself, wash yourself or hit yourself or whatever, that would be a middle voice in Greek. So we'll get into the fine line distinctions on that a little bit later on. Now, so all we're worried about now is active voice. and indicative mood. Now, the other moods are like the subjunctive and the optative and so forth, imperative. Imperative means a command is being made, and subjunctive has got the idea of possibility. And it's a little bit harder to get an intuitive idea for it until we get into it. But indicative means it's just simply making a statement. So all we're looking at is our indicative active forms. Okay, so let's break it down then. First of all, we want to consider the present tense. And I've kind of outlined this. If you want to follow an outline format, that's fine. So Roman number one, present tense. And these are all indicative active forms. That'd be a broad category for the whole thing. Okay, the present tense. Now, how do we form the present tense? Well, basically it breaks down to this. It's formed by the present base plus present ending. Now, these endings are also known, and we'll see a reason for calling this later on, but the primary active endings. That terminology may not be obvious yet. You don't even need to worry about this terminology now, but just think of them as present endings, and we'll call them primary active endings later on when we start to do other things. Okay, so let's write our paradigm then. First person singular, second person singular, third person singular, first person plural, second person plural, third person plural. Okay? So the standard order in Greek paradigms is first, second, third person, and then first singulars, and then plurals. In Hebrew, it's a little bit different. They start with the third person, then work down to the first. Okay, so the Hebrew and the Greek students, I just remind you of that so you don't get mixed up. And the paradigms are set up differently. Just because Hebrew verb forms are more convenient to use the third person singular form, that's the shortest form for Hebrew. That's the nicest one to start with. Okay, now the model verb that we've been dealing with is luo, so I'll just put the base down, lu, for each one of these. And we're going to add a different ending to each one in order to get our present verb forms. Okay, so for first person singular, it's luo, omega ending. Then it's lues, epsilon iota, lue, epsilon iota sigma for the second person, lue for the third person, luomen, luete, epsilon tau epsilon, and luusi. Or optional nu there, we'll put the nu in parentheses. Okay, we can draw a line down here kind of to separate the base from the endings. So what we have is a present base, lu, plus the present endings. Omega, epsilon iota, sigma, epsilon iota, omicron mu, epsilon nu, epsilon tau, epsilon, omicron mu, epsilon, epsilon sigma, omicron mu, epsilon, sigma iota, optional nu. So that's the ending system that you want to memorize. Now you memorize these endings, and these will stick on to any present verb form. And just if you want to know how to do it, you look up the dictionary forms. Notice omega there, that's the ending. The rest of it's the base. And so if you want to make any of these other forms, just put a different ending on it. That's all there is to it. The presents are real nice. There's not a whole lot of irregularities that you're going to see involving the present tense. You're not going to see stem changes and this type of thing. Is there everything else, it gets involved with the aorist tenses and the futures and so forth. That's where your irregularities show up. Okay, any questions on this? So it's just a matter of memorizing these endings. Yes?
Now, on our quiz and future tests, mm-hmm. when we give the third person plural, do you mm-hmm. want us to put the new in brackets or just do it one way or the other?
Oh, you can do it one way or the other. I'm not going to be too critical. If it's a paradigm type of thing, it might be useful to put down new in parentheses for a paradigm. If it's an actual verb form on a test or something, do whichever one you please, and I won't count it off one way or the other. What you most likely see, the usual distinction, although it's not by any means always this way, but if the next word, suppose you're using it in a sentence, if the next word begins with a vowel, if the next very next word begins with a vowel, you'll tend to see the new. And if the next word begins with a consonant, you're less likely to see the new. I won't say absolutely because it's just not an absolute thing. It has to do mainly with the sound of the thing. And since you'll see it both ways, I wouldn't ever count you wrong for either having it or not having it. But in a paradigm, you might I like to have you write down in parentheses just so that you're aware of the fact that you may see it either way so that you're not thrown into confusion if you see it one way or the other. Okay? So this is the best way to do it for a paradigm. That way you know it's a movable move. Okay. One more point. Aspect. The aspect for the present
is dependent on the context. It's either progressive, or indefinite. And that's determined by context. So there isn't any distinction in the forms in the present tense for progressive or indefinite action. We will see a distinction in the past tenses for that. For the present tense, we have to decide that from context. Okay? Now, a little bit later on, we'll see some other things. There are some more interesting features of this. When you're dealing with participles and so forth, then you will be able to see a difference. But as far as the indicative forms are concerned, you won't. Okay, any questions on... That's all there is to know about the future, really. I mean, about the present. The future's coming up next. Okay.
It's always coming.
All right. Let's look at the future then. The future is formed by taking the present base plus sigma plus present endings. So all we've done is really added a sigma to the stem. That's the only thing that's different about this. This is also the primary active endings again. Okay, going to luo again, first person singular, second person singular, third person singular, and the plurals. Stem lu, same as before. But now we add, the model is the present base, in this case it will be lu, plus sigma, plus present endings, and the first ending is omega, so you get luso, luses, luse, lusomen, lusete, and lususi, optional nu. Okay, so we can maybe draw a dotted line down here to separate the stem, another dotted line here for the sigma. In other words, I'm trying to point out the different morphemes that are involved. We're thinking back to our discussion earlier about morphemes and so forth. We've got the basic morpheme, the lu, indicating the base meaning of the verb. We've got the morpheme sigma indicating future tense, in this term at least. And then we've got the morpheme of the ending indicating the person number. This is often called a person number suffix, as we'll define when we get a little bit more generalized later on, we'll define it that way. Okay, and this would be called a tense form, this is often termed, the sigma there. So that's telling us the tense, this is telling us the person number. And the basic verb base, of course, is telling us what the verb means. All right, now we know, though, that it's not always a simple matter of just adding a sigma on something. Because some things don't end in nice things to add sigmas to. So we had some complications, and that's the way I'll put it down here. You might put down complications. Okay, the complications involve the fact that, first of all, if stem ends in vowel, just add sigma to the base. There's no problem there. But if the stem ends in certain consonants, following changes are necessary. So if the stem ends in certain consonants, following change is necessary. Okay, we have three categories of these. Category A, if the stem ends in a P, beta, phi, or P tau. When you add your sigma to it, plus sigma, it's going to result in a C. That's category A. P, beta, phi, or P tau. Plus sigma is going to result in C. Category B, if the stem ends in a kappa, gamma, phi, double sigma, then you add a sigma to that and you get C. And then the last category, if the stem ends in a delta, theta, or zeta, you add the sigma to that, and the result is just another just a sigma. So in effect, you're just dropping that thing out and putting the sigma on. Okay, so these consonant endings will result in these phonological changes, changes in the sound, in other words. And then in addition to that, another complication is that some future is just irregular. They don't follow anything. Right, exactly. So that's why the future form is the second principal part of the verb, because there's enough irregularity that for the average verb you need to know what the future stem is going to be. There's enough complications. So if the stem ends in a vowel, well, there's no problem. If the stem ends in one of these consonants, then you know what to do with that. If the stem ends in a different consonant besides these, that's the ones that tend to be these irregular ones. If the stem ends in something like a nu or something of that nature, then we have our irregularities and act appropriately. If the stem ends in a sigma, those are often ones that are nasty. So there's the complications there. So yeah, the bottom line of it is you just have to know what each verb does in the future. Except for a nice regular verb, if the verb end, stem ends in a vowel, those tend to be regular all along the board. If it ends in one of these consonants, those aren't too bad either, because once you know this rule, then they're pretty much predictable. And the aorist people generally do the same thing. But there's a lot of them with the futures. The futures will have a stem change. Sometimes the vowels will actually change. There'll be a completely different ending in the stem and so forth.
Okay, and the only ones of those that you need to worry about are the ones that are on page 78 here, where the future was irregular, the ones that had second aorists. So the only irregular futures. You will need to know some about the ones that end in, we had grapho and so forth. You'll need to know what happens to that, but that's pretty much regular. If you know this rule, and if you know, I guess the only ones that are irregular here as far as futures are hurisco becomes hureso, echo becomes hexo, the rough reading. Hamartano becomes hamarteso. If you remember those three, the rest of them are all predictable.
What?
As far as this first test is concerned.
The paradigm finished those off in all the first, second, third, singular, plural. Would just follow right along.
Exactly. Exactly. Same base. For example, hureso here. If you wanted to say first person plural, that would be hureso men. And hureseta, hureseusi. See, in other words, it's just the same stem. Just take the omega off there, and you'll have your stem. And then you just put any one of those endings on that you need. Yes, Mike?
And on the meaning of these things here, mm-hmm. Context defines aspect. Is it fair to say then that any time you see a present tense, say the present indicative, that you can translate it either way? In classes, it's common for whenever we run across a present verb,
mm-hmm.
and it's always translated generally in the indefinite,
mm-hmm.
to always bring out
mm-hmm.
the progressive aspect of it. And I'm wondering if that's a fair thing.
Well, let's just put it this way. Context is the only way you can really decide the issue. Many times the context will not nail it down. And because of that, it's important to remind the student that the progressive aspect is a possibility as well. And oftentimes when that's pointed out, of course, it's real clear. Now, there are some other instances, of course, when we get to a past tense form, then there is a definite distinction between the progressive and the indefinite. So there we have a perfect dogmatic stand as to whether it's progressive or not. Then there's other things where there's participles involved and so forth. And when you start getting participles involved, then this progressive aspect is pretty clear too. But if you're dealing with just a simple present verb form, then you've got to consider both possibilities, look at the context, see what the context tends to favor. Some cases the context may not favor anything. So, and that's often why the translators probably went with an indefinite translation, just to kind of cover all the bases. Instead of committing themselves to a progressive aspect, they just said, well, we'll just translate it indefinitely and a person can understand it either way. And so sometimes we just need to remind ourselves, though, that the Greek does include this progressive idea. That's probably what is the safest thing to do. Okay? All right, that's all the time we have for today. We'll continue this review tomorrow and try to get through that. This way you'll have it all down in paradigm form and so forth in your notes in a simple fashion so you can study it. and be prepared as efficiently as possible. Yes. I needed to talk to you. I checked on that score, and it does bump down to an A. That was the borderline. It was kind of quite unfortunately. So you want to make note of that.
Yes, I can just change it on my own.
Yeah, I changed it in the book.